Welcome to Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. I'm Julia Elliott Brown, the founder and CEO of Enter the Arena. I'm a serial entrepreneur and an expert in raising investment and business growth. Our mission at Enter the Arena is to empower female founders to fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business with investment expertise and business coaching. Here we share the stories of inspirational female founders who've raised investment to inspire you to do the same. You'll hear their honest accounts of what it was really like to secure funding, the highs, the lows, and the challenges they experienced on the journey. And along the way, we'll discuss top tips for how you can be successful too. Today I'm speaking with Claire Copeman, the co-founder of Adventure Tours UK. Now, Adventure Tours UK offers small group tours, retreats, coaching camps and corporate events, which are all focused on adventures in some of the UK's wildest spaces. And all their packages are carefully curated, they are completely sustainable and all inclusive. So it's really all about making it as easy as possible for people to get back out into the wild, back to being adventurers, and putting the UK firmly on the map as an adventure destination for travellers across the globe. And it's certainly been a challenging time in the travel industry over the past couple of years through the pandemic. Really not the easiest time to be securing investment, you might think. But Claire did it, closing her first investment round in April 2020. So let's meet Claire and find out all about her own personal wild adventure in securing that funding. So hi, Claire. It's really lovely to have you here.
Hi, Julia.
So I'm dying to find out all about your business, all about your fundraising journey. But first of all, I'm quite intrigued to know what you were doing before you started this business, because you weren't in the travel industry before you set up Adventure Tours, were you?
No, I wasn't. I was actually in marketing. I'd had a 18-year career in marketing agencies. So throughout that time, I'd worked through several creative and later digital agencies with a whole raft of different types of clients, from some were from a travel background, but also finance, sports, premiership football clubs, all sorts. So a very varied background, which gave me a good founding in all different types of business and sectors. But I guess it was my personal life that led me to creating Adventure Tours UK, with my background outside of work, which was very much being a mountain biker, a trail runner, a hiker, and generally just loving getting outdoors into nature.
Oh, okay. So tell me more. So what was this kind of moment where you thought, actually, there's this opportunity for a business here in adventure tours in the UK? Kind of tell me the light bulb moment.
It was a whole combination of events, actually. It wasn't like a long-term vision that I thought one day I'm going to set up my own adventure holiday business. It just happened. Several things happened at once. The company I was working for, the last marketing agency, was becoming quite a challenging place to work. I was becoming quite unsatisfied with the whole corporate way of life and quite a distant way of working. We were losing that connect with our teams. And an opportunity came up for voluntary redundancy. And it happened at the same time as I was getting married. So there was a whole amount, and I'd just moved house actually the year before. So within the space of 12 months, I'd moved house, was about to get married, and just put my job on the line as well. So it was a real turning point for me. And it was a chance to either crumble because the world had just fallen apart around me and everything I'd built up over the last 18 years had gone, or I could take it as a real opportunity to start afresh. My husband loves to joke that he married a high-flying career woman and a week later I was unemployed, which he loves to remind me of quite often. But within a couple of months, really, Adventure Tours UK was on the table. It didn't have a name at that point, but we'd already started to talk about it. And it was very much a catalyst was the wedding itself and friends of ours coming over from Denmark to join us for the wedding. And whilst they were here, we took them on a little tour around North Wales a few days later to, you know, thank them for making the trip to come and see us and just to show them a little bit of where we live. And both these guys had lived and worked in the UK before. They were familiar with England and with Scotland, but they'd never even heard of Wales. And as these things happen, it was over dinner one night. We'd had a few drinks, a couple of bottles of Prosecco maybe to celebrate the recent wedding. And this whole idea of adventure and holidays and putting Wales on the map and sharing Wales with Denmark and the Danes sort of came about. And anyway, the next morning we woke up with a hangover, thought nothing more of it, and very much thought that was the end of that. And a couple of weeks later, Jakob said, yeah, come on, guys, let's do this. And we're thinking, really? Well, I suppose we could look into it. So my husband did a little bit of research. I was very much on the sideline. But as they did a bit more research into the opportunities, and my husband runs his own mountain bike centre, so he's very much already in that adventure sector, albeit for day activities as opposed to multi-day that we do now. And he knew there was an opportunity for multi-day. There's loads of different adventure activities happening in North Wales in particular, but across Wales and elsewhere in the UK. But people aren't necessarily coming and staying for a long period of time. So he knew there was a gap in the market, did a little bit of research. I started sniffing around thinking this sounds quite interesting. And once I did a bit of my own research, I found some really compelling stats. And I think of all the inbound travellers, all the international travellers that come into the UK every single year, only around 2% of them were making it into Wales, which I found a phenomenal statistic, that only 2% of international travellers into the UK come to Wales. And that spurred me into action. That made me realise how big an opportunity there was. And when you coupled that with the growing adventure market around the world, and you look at all the incredible adventure on the doorstep, that suddenly sounded really exciting. Mm. And so I decided that actually this was something that had legs. This could be my next opportunity. And we really ran with it from there.
Wow, that's really interesting, isn't it? I can't believe it's only 2%. That's shocking. Yeah. Wales has so much to offer, doesn't it? So is it? So just give us a little flavour of the kind of holidays that you do then. Is it all in Wales or is it elsewhere? And what kind of stuff can people book?
So we do all sorts. It's the first thing. At the moment, we're mostly in Wales. But as the name suggests, Adventure Tours UK, we will be UK wide. We want to cover the whole of the UK, including Scotland and England and potentially Northern Ireland as well. We've started in Wales because it's where we're based. We live in North Wales. We know it inside out. For us, it was the easiest starting point. Start with what you know and build out from there. As a tour operator, we needed to establish a very extensive network of small independent local businesses, because everything we do is about supporting the local communities, putting back into those communities, you know, sustainable travel as well from an environmental perspective. So we don't want to rush at it and try and spread ourselves too thin. We wanted to focus on building that network from Wales out. Mm. So that's why Wales currently, but we're already, from next year, we'll be into Scotland as well, which is really exciting. That'll be our first foray outside of Wales, and we've got other destinations around the UK in mind too. And in terms of the types of adventure, again, we do all sorts. We do everything from a really gentle, mindful walking weekend, which is a simple two-night break. It's a chance to get out, reconnect with nature, but most importantly, to reconnect with yourself as well through mindfulness. And we have a qualified mindfulness teacher and hill walker who takes you out into the beautiful countryside of the Berwyn Hills and will teach you how to use meditations with your senses. Through to a wild wellness retreat, which is also very gentle. It's a nice, easy way for people to access the outdoors if perhaps they're not, you know, comfortable with it generally. Maybe they're more of an urban liver. And then we have our out-and-out adventure hardcore products, like our 8-day multi-activity Adventure North Wales trip, where we take you coasteering and canyoning and river bugging and rafting, and we basically get you to jump off cliffs into water and do crazy things and leave you fairly exhausted at the end of your week's holiday. So it's a good mix, and trail running, mountain biking, and everything in between.
Sounds amazing. I want to book on one of these holidays immediately. So you and your husband self-funded the business at the start. You know, how did it feel taking that risk together?
It was quite different for me, because he's obviously been self-employed for the last 15 years. It felt like he was in his territory. But for me, this was the first foray outside of a very reliable salaried job. And obviously, I'd left that salaried job behind. I think a lot of people tend to start up their own business alongside their work and then eventually transition from one to the other. I'd already taken the plunge. So it was kind of an all or nothing, and we knew we needed to make it work. But back at the beginning, when I first noticed that statistic that got me hooked, I did say to my husband, we go big or we go home. There is no point doing this half-heartedly. So we're either in and it's scalable or we're not. So I was quite clear with that from the outset. And he was also committed. And obviously there's an element of with being in it together. He knows that he's the only person with a steady income currently. I wasn't going to have that for some time if we were going to plow everything into this business. So it was a big decision to make. But I think in many ways, it's actually brought us even closer together because we've got this shared, obviously we were on a journey together anyway as husband and wife, but we had very distinct working lives, and now it's very much interlinked. And I think it's been a really positive thing for us.
That's really good. So you always had that ambition then that it was going to be high growth, something you wanted to scale. So does that mean that you, from the outset, knew that you would probably need to get some investment to help you grow, or was that something that came a bit later?
It wasn't something that either of us actually thought of immediately. And in fact, my husband's own business has grown to be very successful. He'll never admit it, but it is very successful. But it's been a very organic growth over 15 years to get where he and his business partner are with that. However, we were very fortunate that we actually met a business mentor through his connections through his other business. And that mentor has a background in travel. He understood life as a tour operator. He understood a lot of the challenges that we didn't even know were out there yet. And also his role as a mentor was about, you know, small business growth. So he was the one who planted the seed very early on. I think before we even registered the company name, he'd said at some point, you'll need investment, you know, tour operations, travel, it's a slow burn. You work 12 to 18 months in advance. You need resource in order to get the sales in 12 months or 18 months time. You've got to pay for that resource. And we sat there and thought, that's a really good point. Actually, there's only so much that we can grow this on our own, and we will need that investment to grow the team to move us forward, especially at the rate at which we wanted to do it.
All right. So let's talk about this fundraising journey then. So it was always that seed had been planted quite early on, funded it yourself. You got, how far did you get before you were ready for funding? What point did you kind of go, right, we need to now go out and start seeking that finance?
I think as soon as that seed had been planted, we kind of, it was almost part of our whole financial forecasting and modelling from the beginning. I guess a lot happened in those first few months as we were going through the motions of registering the business, setting up the bank account, registering for our tour operator licence, all those things. We were doing all this big financial planning in the background, and it we sort of thought, actually, with a cash injection, we can quite quickly grow the team and help us to move forward. So we built it into the plan from the outset. We launched the business in terms of having an online presence through which you could book from December 2018 with a hurry. We know that through my experience working with other travel operators in the past, I know that January to March is the absolutely key booking time. So we had to get the website out before Christmas. That was a must. We needed to advertise throughout January, February to have any chance of getting off the ground for 2019. So we did that. But we also knew that 2019 would be a slow year. So we really wanted to build the brand in that year. It was all about brand building. So it wasn't about delivering a high quantity of tours, but it was about delivering the right tours that were high profile. So we did an awful lot of work with various agencies, including some kind of like Visit Wales, for example, and other destination management organisations, which allowed us to run quite a few PR trips. So we did they required an awful lot of handholding, a lot of input and work, don't necessarily pay brilliantly, but got us exposure, and they built our reputation within the Welsh travel industry very quickly. And that was all done very deliberately to give us a case to put forward to investors. So throughout the summer of 2019, in the background, we were also developing our investor prospectus with a view to at the end of that first year, not even quite a full year actually of being registered, we would go out to seek investment.
And that's clever thinking, because you already have in mind, this is what we're going to need to prove out to investors. So yes, putting those steps in place as you went which I mean, actually, even if you're not seeking investment, that's the kind of stuff you should be doing, right? Because it's about proving that you have a market for what you're offering.
Exactly. And I do think in some ways that's where my background in marketing, and particularly being in that senior management team of a marketing and digital company later on, put me in good stead, because I was very much about building a brand. I understand the value of a brand. So, and that's part of it, is putting out this perception of who you are, whether that's the perception to potential customers or perception to potential investors. But that is a big part of it. And obviously, then you've got to very quickly back it up. You can't be, you know, all, you know, pretty pictures and things, as people always say to me. But you do have to have that brand in place. So my kind of focus really for that first year was make us look as established as possible. You know, people in that first year would come on our website and be like, oh my god, this looks amazing, how long have you been going? And I'd be like, about 6 months. but we never looked like a small business that was, you know, a small young business. We kind of hit the ground, I think, running, looking like we were going to go places.
That's right. I mean, if you want to go big, you've got to play big, haven't you, and create that impression from the get-go. Really sensible strategy. So thinking about going and getting investors, what were you nervous about that? I mean, was there anything you were worried about thinking about getting investors?
Absolutely. I think you have that worry of, part of you absolutely 110% believes in what you're doing, but at the same time worry, like, will somebody else get it? Will they understand me? And I think that worry of finding the wrong people, you hear so many horror stories, because we were very specifically looking for angel investment. And you just hear so many stories where actually the investor isn't completely aligned with you. They don't perhaps share your objectives. You know, we, although it was only early days, we'd already invested, you know, 12 months of our life into this. You know, my redundancy payout was invested in it. You know, we'd spent quite a bit of money getting it off the ground to this point. And the thought of then having to sign over part of it to somebody else that we didn't know, it's really quite daunting, because you can't undo that. If you make a mistake, there's, you know, barely a second chance with it. So that was a very, that was front of mind for us a lot. We had very good coaching from our mentor. He prepared us, I think, as well as he could have done. A lot of the advice he gave us has resulted in where we are today.
Getting that support and helping you navigate the process is so important, isn't it? And like you say, I mean, it's interesting, you're obviously in business with your husband, so you have the marriage, your business is a marriage, and then you're looking at inviting somebody else into that space, which is, you know, quite a nerve-wracking thing, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. And yeah, we had to get it right. And you know, that was very much how our mentor told us to approach it, was think of this as a marriage. You're about to marry somebody else. If you've got any doubts, do not do it. So I think every, you know, as we approach this whole investment sort of journey, that was a mindset we had. Part of you is going, but we just need the money. And the other part of you is going, but not just any money.
Really important. You don't want the wrong money.
Yeah.
So where did you start? How did you go about finding your investors?
We actually went through the Development Bank of Wales to begin with. Obviously, you know, we're based in Wales. The Development Bank of Wales is an asset that we can draw on. Again, our mentor actually made that introduction to us. And so we were listed on their portal, and they contacted the various investors that they have on their records, and the wheels started to move slowly. And it felt like we'd really pushed so much effort into this, and we were trying to race as quickly as we could to get out there and find these investors. And suddenly our bit was done and it was in somebody else's hands, and we had to wait for the right people to come along.
So it went up on their website and then you were waiting for people to come to you. But that's great, going to get that local support. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs overlook that. They think, oh, it's got to be, you know, the investment scene in London. And actually, there are so many regional development funds and organisations that desperately want to support growing businesses outside of the capital.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, we although at first we sat there and we kind of, I'm not very good at waiting. You might have gathered that already. I'm not the kind of person that sits and waits for things to come to me. I like to go out and get them. So for me, it was quite alien. And I think after the first month or so, I was getting very itchy feet, thinking, I don't want to just sit here and wait. I've done all of this work, and I've just put my business's future in someone else's hands, and it doesn't mean the same to them as it does to me. So I started looking at other ways that we could maybe go out and try and look for, actually find angel investors. So through companies such as Grant Thornton, for example, they invited me along to one of their pitching days, which was a terrifying experience, but I'm really glad that I did it. But that was a case of, you know, going along to an event where I think there was five businesses in total, five young startups. We were all invited to have a 5-minute pitch, and there was a room full of probably about 40 potential investors in this room. And we each had to stand, with no presentation, nothing. You just had to stand there in front of 40 investors and pitch your soul out to them and convince them in 5 minutes max. And they cut you off. If you weren't done in 5 minutes, that was it. It ended. And one poor guy pitched and they cut him off. And he said, "Oh, that was the fastest 10 minutes I've ever had." And everyone went, "It was five." And he'd planned his pitch to be twice the length that it should have been. So that was a really interesting experience. And you know, we actually started to get some real interest from that. So that's another way of looking at it.
Pitch events can be quite good, can't they? There are pitch events and there are pitch events, some where the audience perhaps isn't as actively engaged in the investment world as you might hope, but you got some interest.
We did, actually, yes. Yeah, it did feel like quite an engaged audience, actually. But what I will say is that, for me, I was going in with a tourism business, and quite an unusual tourism business. There's so many, you know, online resellers out there, like OTAs, people who are doing big flashy sales to, you know, African safaris, and we were selling holidays in Wales. Basically, wasn't quite as glamorous. It certainly wasn't fintech or any other kind of tech, and it did feel like 95% of the room were there for tech investments only, and I had to fight damn hard to be heard and to be taken seriously in terms of what we were doing. But I did have three investors afterwards wanted to have a good long chat with me, and two of them we followed up with afterwards, who are actually really keen to learn much more about us, start looking at our numbers, understanding more about where we were headed with the business.
Okay, so where did the investors that you found in the end, where did they come from?
They actually came through the original route, which was the Development Bank of Wales. So right at the very end of, you're allowed a 3-month slot on their portal, and then you can have a 1-month extension. And we had the 1-month extension, and in week 3 of that month's extension, another newsletter went out, and our now investors happened to spot it, thought that looks interesting, and they reached out. So, yeah, it felt very last minute, but it happened just in time.
Fantastic. And so tell us about the process you went through of getting to know those investors and thinking quite carefully about whether you were going to invite them into your marriage and business.
I think the first thing that made our ears prick about these particular investors was that we'd met with several other investors previously that had come through the Development Bank of Wales. But there felt like a real mismatch of characters. We were never that comfortable. They wanted to interrogate our spreadsheet, interrogate our valuation. They wanted to lower our valuation. It was all numbers, 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 which of course is a big part of the investment. These investors came to Development Bank and said, "We've seen the newsletter. We've seen Adventure Tours UK. We're really interested. We don't want to look at their spreadsheets just yet, thank you. We'd like to meet them. We want to have a coffee and we want to have a chat." And we immediately thought, brilliant. They actually want to get to know us and understand why we're doing this before we start interrogating numbers. So that was really good. So we met them for a drink one evening. And I think when we all realised that about 2.5-3 hours had passed and we were still nattering away, we realised there was a connection, and that this had real potential. They were interested in us. We had lots of shared interests. We actually all live quite locally. They share our passions for cycling in particular, actually, but also just general kind of being active, being outdoors, enjoying the Welsh countryside. So it felt like there was a real connection there. So at the end of that session, we realised we hadn't really touched on that much about the business in terms of the financials. So that should be the next step. But it felt like a really positive meeting. So after that, we started to meet up. And we had several sessions together, probably kind of for, you know, half a day or more at a time, going through the numbers, going through the plans, going through our goals and objectives as a business, understanding our exit plan so they could understand what that meant for their exit plan. And we obviously reached a point where we felt that we were all happy to move forward and it was time to engage the legal teams.
Yeah, fantastic. But finding people that get what you do is so important, isn't it? Especially at that early stage, because if then you're pushing on an open door.
Yeah, exactly. They understood it. We'd found that with some of the other people we'd spoken with, they couldn't understand why anybody would want to go on holiday in the UK. And we said, but we're not selling the holiday to you. You know, we're selling the holiday to, we're looking at people coming from America or Scandinavia or elsewhere in Europe or Australia. We're looking, this is an international world-class destination. And they couldn't see it. They could only picture it as people going out of the country. Whereas the investors we have now, they just got it from day one. They completely understood what we were picturing and what we were trying to build.
So let's talk about timing then. So because timing is so important when it comes to raising investment. First of all, how long did this process take of the kind of, you've talked already about you were in month four of being on the website when you first came across your investors. How long was this getting to know you process?
This part of it actually all moved relatively quickly. We were very lucky actually, because we had been told to expect it to take several months. We had a bit of a time frame in place from the outset to SEIS funding and the tax year. That actually provided a one deadline that we needed to work with. So in the grand schemes of angel investment, you know, we met with this these investors at the end of January, I think it was. And we knew that we only had a really up until the end of March. So we had really just over a 2 month window to complete this in. And that is pretty quick turnaround. It still felt like a lifetime for us because we were still chomping at the bit and desperate to move forward and couldn't really until we had this sorted. But in reality, 2 months is pretty quick.
Yeah, but I suppose for them, I mean, the fact that it's SEIS, and for those who aren't familiar with that, so it's the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme, and you can look it up online. It's a UK government tax scheme that really supports very early stage founders, makes it really tax efficient for investors to come in, doesn't it? Because less of their capital is at risk. So the interest is there on both parts, isn't it? You want to get it done before the end of the tax year, but so do they. Yes, so everybody is working towards a timescale. Now, in context, so this is January 2020, and you're talking about getting it done by the end of March 2020. And of course, what happens? A global pandemic that shuts down the travel industry. That must have been fun.
Yeah, you couldn't write it, really, could you? I mean, it was, we almost simultaneously as the conversation started and we were getting to know the investors. Obviously, I deal with clients and people all around the world. You know, I've got clients based in Australia and in Sweden and all over the place. This was happening in other parts of the world long before it got to the UK. So I was hearing a lot in the travel press and picking it up in my conversations with trade clients that this thing called coronavirus was happening and it seemed quite serious. And day by day, it was getting worse and worse. And I'm saying to my husband, there's this thing called coronavirus and I think it's coming. And he's going, oh no, I think it's fine. I don't think it'll get here. I was like, no, it's sweeping through the world pretty quickly. I think it's going to get here. What do we do? Do we just keep quiet? What do you do? Because we didn't know what we were dealing with at that point. We knew it had potential to knock us sideways in terms of the investment. But at that point, no one had the vision of actually where we are today. So we obviously couldn't and we wouldn't have kept it hidden, but before we knew it, it hit the news in the UK, it became mainstream. And I always remember incredibly clearly on the 23rd of March, we went into lockdown in the UK. And quite frankly, my world fell apart. We lost everything overnight. We lost all those bookings we built up in those first few months. Throughout January, February, it was like, everything, the last 18 months of hard work had paid off, all the money we'd sunk into it, all the 7 days a week I'd been working, plus another job alongside to pay the bills and it was hard work to get there, and bookings were coming in, and we'd won our first trade contract, which was worth £100,000 for this first year, and we got our investors on board, and it just went overnight. It just disappeared. We lost all the bookings, we lost our trade contract, and we were fairly certain that the investment contract was about to follow suit. And we were fairly devastated. It was a turning point.
But the investment didn't fall through.
It didn't. And I think that is absolutely testament to having the right investors on board. They could have walked away at that point easily. There was no commitment, no legal commitment at all. But they felt a very strong moral commitment. And for me, that spoke volumes. You know, we had a very frank conversation with them about, you know, what it meant. We had to obviously say, it looks like we've lost everything for this year, but hopefully we can win it back. And we all thought that travel would return in, at that point, everyone was thinking maybe a month, 6 weeks, is it 2 months, but it'll bounce back. It's still a big risk. They had a little bit of time to think about it, understandably. Their lawyer in the meantime, so we'd engaged lawyers on both sides. We both racked up several £1,000s in legal fees that we had to pay whether we signed contracts or not. And their lawyer advised them in no uncertain terms to not proceed. Do not go ahead. Do not invest in a travel company at this stage. If you're smart about this, you will leave them, and basically, when they're on their knees, you will go back and offer them less for more of their company. Yeah. That was the very brutal advice that their lawyer gave to them, which I can't really argue with it, but it would have been a pretty cruel thing to do. And thankfully, they turned around and said, thank you very much for your advice, but we're not those people. We've made a commitment. We really believe in Claire and Jim. We believe in this business, and we're going to honour the commitment that we've put on the table to them.
Wow, those are some amazing investors you've got there.
They really are. And don't get me wrong, you know, they're not daft. They did change, some terms did change. And really the only change was they didn't take advantage of the situation at all. They simply built in a means to protect themselves and their money, which is absolutely fair enough. And had they not, I might have questioned their sanity. So I think, you know, for them to come back with the terms they did, which was simply that we were going to stagger the investment. So we weren't going to get it all in one lump sum. There was two of them investing. One needed to make their investment, which was the smaller portion of the deal anyway, before that end of tax year. The other investor actually had longer. They needed to invest in the following tax year. So we agreed that we would go ahead with a small proportion. It was about 20% of the investment would go ahead there and then, and it would give us enough cash into the business to keep us going over the next few months whilst we all figured out what was happening with the world. And that we had set ourselves a deadline of November for the second part of the investment, which would be reviewed closer to the date. And we'd simply see, how's the world looking? How are we looking as a business? Does it make sense for them to put that remaining money into us? So it was not a done deal. And we spent the next few months, obviously, kind of with that hanging over us, but at the same time, getting to know them actually as well, even more over those next few months, and really feeling confident that we had found the right partners to come on board. And they do feel more like partners than investors. They've absolutely stuck by us throughout this. And when it came to that decision making in November, officially the line was, if the world and the travel industry isn't in a better place by November, we won't invest. And we knew that the world and the travel industry was not in a better place by November last year, but we also felt quite confident that that would not stop them at this point, because they knew that we had actually delivered a very strong business throughout that time, the limited trading we could do. And we'd all built up that level of trust in each other, that they knew that we were not the kind of people to just simply squander their money. And we knew that they would be there to back us when we needed it.
And I guess by that point, we were starting to see a route to exit from the pandemic. You know, there was a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, there was and there wasn't. If you think about where we were at that point, especially in Wales, we had had 6 weeks of trading. We were allowed to operate throughout August and September. The reality is we only had trips planned up until the middle of September, though. So we literally had 6 weeks of trading that year. That was it. And we got to October, and the county that I live in and the county next door where the investors live, both counties went into a local lockdown. So suddenly, the month before we have to make our decision, we're back in lockdown. We can't leave our counties. You know, by the following month, Wales was in a national fire break, a lockdown by any other name. And a few weeks after that, the whole of the UK was back into a lockdown. So actually, yes, we'd had that little glimmer of light, but suddenly we were plunged back into darkness again.
So challenging. But you know, what's interesting about that is that the way that, you know, staggering investment, I mean, obviously for you made a huge amount of sense given everything that was going on in the world, but actually it can be quite a clever way to structure an investment round anyway, where future is uncertain, where milestones can be proven out before more funding gets released, and it can work really well for both parties. So I think that's something that all founders should consider when they're thinking about a fundraising round. Do I really need it right now, or can I tranche this? Sometimes that means you can get a better valuation on a second and third tranche. Sometimes it's just about hitting those milestones and de-risking it a bit. But
exactly. I think it is something that it's something that we hadn't really considered before it was put on the table in front of us as the only option, really. We hadn't thought about it, but absolutely. I mean, because it was never our plan. We didn't need like a big we weren't looking for some kind of big capital spend. We weren't looking to go out and buy equipment or anything like that. We were looking for that money to sustain us over a period of time. So actually, there was no advantage or disadvantage to us of whether or not we had this lump sum in the bank account from day one or not. And actually, you do realise, you know, you get all excited about getting an investment, and it is really exciting. It's a huge responsibility, especially when they're angel investors. They are people. They're just like you and I. They're not bottomless money pits quite often. They're just regular people who've made a success of things, and they have something available to reinvest. They still need that money in the long run. It's not generally there for you to just lose. That's quite a responsibility. And as soon as that money lands in your account, you realise that the level of trust that's been put in you, it's actually staggering. It eases that pressure a little bit.
So tell me a bit, let's just finish off a little bit by talking about the dynamic of being a male and female co-founding team, and how, if it did influence how you ran the pitch process. What did you see? What did you experience?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think because I've always been quite a strong, independent woman, but at the same time, mindful that, you know, not everybody wants to invest in a woman. Maybe I certainly found myself in very male dominated environments, but ones I wasn't familiar with. I was used to being in a male dominated environment. When you work in a digital agency, it's mostly men. When you sit around the senior management table of a digital agency, it's mostly men. So I was used to holding my own, but in a field that I knew and understood. And suddenly I was sitting around board tables talking to lots of middle-aged men who seemed to be looking down on me, you know. And it was actually reassuring to have, maybe it's slightly different because he's my husband as well, but it was reassuring to have, you know, him alongside me. I often would I always try to be very fair. So I'll often say, you know, point out to people, I am the co-founder. I'm the co-founder alongside Jim, my husband. And sometimes I do that with fairness. And sometimes I think I did it, especially at that investment stage, to make sure that people understood there was two of us. There was a man involved. It wasn't just me. I don't honestly know with hindsight how much of a difference that made, how much it did. Maybe to some people it would have made a difference. I don't think with the investors we have, it actually would have mattered one bit whether it was just me on my own or Jim on his own or the two of us together. I think they bought into the business and the idea and us as individuals. But I think I probably did make sure that there was no potential sign of weakness by always having that mention, which I kicked myself a little bit for.
Yeah, it's interesting that you felt like that, isn't it? I wonder how much of that, when you look back, is how comes from you and how much of it was from what you actually experienced. I mean, you said you felt like they were sort of looking down on you. Can you sort of pinpoint what it was that made you feel that way?
I can't really, to be honest. No, I struggle. I think sometimes, especially in some of those early meetings with the investors we did not go ahead with, there was definitely a lot more eye contact between them and my husband than you know, between them and me, I didn't always feel like they were talking to me or addressing me. It was like, you know, the hard questions were put to him. And then he would generally look at me and I'd be like, well, I'll answer that because that's my information. It's my data. These are my stats and this is my business. I brought him along as the pity face. But it did often feel perhaps that I wasn't getting the focus that I deserved in those meetings. There was a lot of, you know, eyes drawn to the man at the table. Mm. So it was nothing too overt, but it did feel that way at times. Yeah, but we also felt that they weren't the right people for us.
Well, obviously it can be a real red flag, but it can be quite subtle. And I think it's just really important to discuss that because it is subtle and it's hard to see it. You can see it more clearly sometimes when there is a man in the room because you can feel the difference. Yeah. But I think a lot of investors, and I, you know, the investors that are listening to this should just be mindful of that potential behavior and the impact it can have and how it might make a female founder feel. And actually, as a consequence, you quite quickly realize that they probably weren't the right fit. So, you know, they have lost out on an opportunity there too. So I think it's really important that we do call these things out, even though they might feel quite minor, the impact can be quite significant.
Yeah, and I think even, you know, the pitching event that I went to with Grant Thornton, of the five investors that pitched, I was the only female, of the five entrepreneurs that pitched, I was the only female entrepreneur. So chatting to the others beforehand, I wouldn't say I'm not paranoid about being the only woman, but you're aware that you're the only woman that's about to stand up in front of everybody. And of all those 40 odd investors in the room, you could easily count on one hand the amount that were female. So it was a very male dominated environment, and it doesn't affect how you perform if you like in that scenario, but you do wonder how it might affect your chances. And as I said, a lot of the others had tech businesses that they were putting forward, and I wasn't tech, so I probably felt more disadvantaged by that. But interestingly, of the three investors that approached me at the end of that event to talk further, all three of them were male. Actually, not one single female investor approached me.
Yeah, it's a very common experience that you talk about, you know, in terms of the how many female founders you will be in the room with, and again often presenting to a sea of men in suits. It's quite common, and I think we just have to accept that that's the situation, that it's changing, but it's changing reasonably slowly, and I think as female founders we just have to learn the language of investors and know how to play in that arena, so to speak. So
language is an interesting point that you touch on, because I'm often aware that I don't always use the most businessy language. You know, everyone's got their acronyms and shorthand for things, and I don't tend to speak like that. I understand it absolutely, and you know, I know my business inside out, but I don't like jargon. I don't dress it up in that way, and I often wonder how much that it does that go against me. I don't know, do I need to change the way that I speak to people in order to be heard better? But there's all sorts of questions like that go through your mind. I think one thing that did stand out to me was I do think that what would really help is if we had more female investors out there, and if those female investors, obviously whatever investment they go into, it's got to be right for them, it's got to be the right business, it's got to be the sector they understand and are interested in, but just a little bit more encouragement for those female founders in the room that maybe helps to put us in better stead or take a little bit more notice, see if we can help to build each other up.
I couldn't agree more. Well, thankfully, you did find your needle in the haystack. Yes. And found some investors that believe in you, can see beyond the fact that you're not a tech business and share your passions, and also that you can quite comfortably go out for a drink with and have a 3-hour conversation with, which is super important, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. We've had a few good nights out with them since.
I mean, congratulations as well. I mean, for closing that deal with everything that was going on in 2020, you know, that's amazing. So what's been going on with the business since? I mean, obviously we're sort of coming out of lockdown tentatively. Are things picking up? What's going to be next for you, Claire?
Absolutely. It's been a roller coaster year. We started this year taking on our first employee as we got ready to reopen, which we all thought was going to be from March. And then actually March, everything got cancelled. April was cancelled. May was cancelled. But by June, suddenly we were delivering more trips in that month than we ever had done in the whole of our history to that point. So we took on board an operations manager back in January, who's been working brilliantly alongside me to get all of our kind of logistics, you know, the tour operations logistics is a minefield, especially throughout COVID and all the changing restrictions. So it's been a very challenging year. She's been an absolute superstar. We've since taken on another full-time employee earlier this summer, and we've just taken on a young girl through the Kickstart scheme as well, which is fantastic. So one thing I do love to do is to really kind of coach and mentor young people, young girls into, you know, their potential careers. So that's a really fantastic opportunity that we've been able to have ourselves and offer to someone else. And the tours have been flying, you know, from we only really had four fully operational months because up to September is our peak season. So we're into a quiet season now, but June through to September was phenomenal. You know, we've carried several hundred people. We've done tours all across the whole of Wales. We're now ready to deliver tours in Scotland next year. And our sustainability message has become bolder and bolder over the last 12 months, which is something that we're all really excited about.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully there's now a prevailing wind behind you as everybody is desperate to get back out there. But I think also the kind of the shift, as you say, towards sustainability being absolutely critical, and also getting back into nature. Kind of, it feels like everything is kind of on your side now.
I mean, I hope so. I think so. It feels like we're in the right space for where the world is at right now. People do want to escape the hustle and bustle, get back to nature, reconnect. You know, mental well-being has become such a hot topic, if you like, but rightly so, because it is so important. And so many people have struggled with that. But getting out into nature, being active, they're two big ways of managing it. So that's why we have things like the Wild Wellness Retreat and the Mindful Walking. It's really tapping into that need that people have found they have throughout lockdown. It's been really challenging for everybody in different ways. I'm lucky that I live where I do in the hills. You know, being cooped up has not been a problem I've suffered with. I've had different challenges throughout lockdown. But other people, they've had a secure job, but they've been cooped up in a flat in London for months on end. So everyone's had different challenges. And I do feel like we're really well placed to, capture that change in mood that the nation's felt and that the world is feeling in general. And sustainability was something we always had in our DNA, but I probably hid it away a little bit more than I should have done because I was worried about it looking a bit too fluffy and will it affect our investment opportunities. Actually, now I confidently believe that, you know, actually being sustainable is a boost to the bottom line, and it's what makes you future proof. And right now it makes you much more attractive than companies who simply don't care about their impacts on the world. So all of those things are things we truly believe in, and it feels like everything's falling into place finally.
Well, you deserve it. You deserve the success. Well done for riding it out. And I don't know about everybody else, but I feel like I need to go and book a holiday.
Come and join us.
Thank you so much, Claire, for sharing your journey. Well done. And we really look forward to watching you and seeing your continued success.
Thank you so much, Julie. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for following Fundraising Stories with Female Founders. This content is all provided to you for free, so if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe so you never miss another one. Enter the Arena has helped hundreds of female founders fly through pre-raise and investment and onto the exponential growth of their business. Our first-hand experience, expert guidance, and proven programs help female founders unleash the Wonder Woman inside. To see if we can help you do the same, head over to www.enterthearena.co.uk. I'm Julia Elliott-Brown, and I look forward to talking with you soon.